Hello and welcome back to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. Now, as immigrants and kids of immigrants, we are often told the same story, that America is a meritocracy, that if we work hard, study hard, dream big, we can make it. But here's the thing. The deeper I go into my own journey, the degrees, the hard-earned accomplishments, the check boxes of success, the more I wonder, where would I be if I had the same credentials, the same drive, but also the privilege of whiteness? Now, don't get me wrong. I am proud of what I've achieved. But I can't help thinking, have I been quietly, systemically held back without ever realizing it? Well, today's episode will push you to ask similar questions. Today, we are diving into the structural realities behind those invisible barriers. Things we are not supposed to talk about. Things like exclusion, racialized policy, and generational disadvantage. Not just at the federal level, but baked into state systems, like in Texas. My guests today, Jennifer Hook and James Beckmeyer, are the authors of Texas-Style Exclusion, a deeply researched and eye-opening book that lays out how immigrant families, specifically Mexican immigrant families, are denied access to education and social services in ways that shape their lives for decades. So listeners, take a deep breath. This conversation might shake your understanding of fairness, success, and what it really means to belong in America. Because the truth, it's not always easy, it's not always comfortable, but it's time we talked about it. So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly. So excited to have you here. How are both of you doing?
Great today.
Doing good, thanks.
So I was talking to Jennifer before I pressed record, and it's an interesting time for a lot of us. We are feeling a lot of emotions, not great ones. So this conversation seems pretty apt to be had right now. And I'll jump right in to your book's title. It's called Texas Style Exclusion. It's scary. And it is a strong phrase. What does it mean?
This really refers to the situation that was occurring in Texas in the early parts of the 20th century until the 70s or maybe even the 80s. It may be a throwback from sort of the pre-civil rights era. In Jim Crow South era, if you want to think about it that way, that really thought and used immigrants from Mexico as primarily a source of labor, right? And so a lot of plantation owners and growers at that back in the early 20th century were recruiting Mexicans from Mexico to come and work for them. But that was really the sole purpose, right? And so they deliberately, and we have historical accounts showing this, deliberately excluded them and their children from the institutions that made upward mobility possible. And so we're talking about that kind of exclusion.
Give me an example of institutions you're referencing here.
Sure. Yeah, we're primarily focused in the book since what we're really looking at in terms of outcomes are the educational attainment of the children and the grandchildren of immigrants during the industrial era And so Texas style exclusion is kind of a historical lesson. And we've kind of capitalized on the fact that at this time in America during the industrial era, there was a lot of variation in terms of the institutional development across states and regions of the country. And this was especially true with the development of the American public school system. I won't get into kind of the details of that unless you want to, but what it meant was that at this time during, you know, leading into the First and Second World Wars, we were really beginning to develop a modern schooling system that eventually became uniform across the nation. An example would be, you know, most public school systems, I think, would go to school for 180 days during the year. We didn't reach that level of kind of uniformity in our schooling institutions until at least the 1950s. And so what that means is that historically we had, and this is a period of high immigration, we had, you know, immigrants entering different institutional contexts, specifically with respect to their schooling. And so this was a time, there was a lot of debate about schooling, and it was an era when schooling was becoming compulsory. So to get to your question, what is an example? This is an example, is that in some parts of the country that were really influenced by what was known as the progressive era movement of Americanization, there was an effort to compel kids into school. Whereas in Texas, the way the institutions were set up and controlled more by people with local interests in terms of how the economy was set up there, the impetus was the opposite. It was to, as Jenny was saying, it was to keep especially Mexican origin children out of school because they were viewed as a valuable kind of source of labor.
This is such an interesting point, but I do want to expand this conversation a bit and talk about the educational gaps that you are referring to, right? These gaps, contrary to what some of us may think, did not emerge randomly. This was a result of policies, decisions, as you mentioned, to limit the opportunity generation after generation. Let's talk a little bit about the policies that were enacted at the time to prevent Mexican immigrants and their kids, basically their kids, from accessing education in Texas.
So we get a lot of our information from a historian, David Montejano, and he has this wonderful history of Texas throughout the 20th century. He also then relies on source material and interviews that were conducted during the 1930s and 40s. Some of the mechanisms or the ways in which children were kept out of school, especially Mexican kids were kept out of school. There were several of them. So one was segregation. There were sort of Mexican towns and then there were Anglo towns, you know, and the Mexican workers would be segregated, forced to live in Mexican towns. And my understanding from Montejano's work is that the school systems in the Mexican towns would go, say, up to sixth grade. And then if they wanted to go beyond sixth grade, they would have to move over to another town. And of course, then what we saw in our actual census data was that there was a big cliff between sixth grade and seventh grade. So the kids would go up to sixth grade because that was local, that was available to them. But then it was a lot of effort and work and extra expense to the families to then move on to seventh grade. And so a lot of kids just dropped out at that time.
Was it just access to education or was it more than that? Quality of education, something that we don't often talk about. When you say kids had access until sixth grade locally, what were some of the differences between the quality of education that they were acquiring in those local Mexican towns?
We're a little limited in terms of what we can actually look at through our census records. But my understanding is that if you just look at the funding situation, a lot of the funds were funneled to the white schools. And so there would be unequal funding as well. And many of these cases ended up in federal or even the Supreme Court later on in the 20th century, in the 1970s and 1980s. And, you know, so we know that this was happening because of the documentation of it in those court cases. And so in terms of the resources that went to the Mexican schools, I suspect, but I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that those kids were getting far fewer funds sort of allocated to pay for their education. So that would mean the teachers were not getting paid as much and probably fewer resources in the schools and worse buildings.
To step back and talk about the era that you chose, which was early 20th century, and also your focus on Mexican immigrants. Why is that?
We get asked this question a lot. There's a lot of answers to that question. Neither of us are of Mexican origin. And so I think that's one of the questions that we get sometimes is like, why are you focusing on this group? And I think it has to do with the fact that when we think about Americans' feelings and approach to immigration these days, they're often very sympathetic to the integration stories of European immigrants who arrived during the industrial era. And many, many white people today can trace their origins maybe back three or four generations to that very large wave of immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe during the early 20th century. A lot of these people, including my own family and maybe some of Jim's family, have lots of stories and the success stories that they have about how that when they first arrived, they were so poor and then they worked super hard and made it and became successful in America. And then when they look at some of the lower educational attainments of Mexican immigrants today and their children and grandchildren, they tell a different story. There's a lot of blame going around in terms of saying they depend too much on public assistance and they don't work hard enough and see what happened. And so there's implicit kinds of comparisons being made between these two groups. And we really wanted to take this head on and think about, oh, whoa, 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 how much support did your family really get? And so we kind of characterize this as a form of contemporary nearsightedness. And so when we look into the past, we don't have a very clear picture of really what the challenges were and what kinds of public support our grandparents actually got. This is a particularly interesting time period because there's a lot of people migrating to the United States at that time, but European immigrants tended to settle in the Northeast and the Midwest. And those were the places that invested heavily in public schooling.
Was it because of who the immigrants were, where the immigrants were coming from? Or was it in general they were investing more? So, for instance, when you say European immigrants were moving into the Midwest and there was a lot of investment in education, do you think if, for instance, Mexican immigrants were to move to the Midwest, would the amount of money invested in education be different given who the immigrant makeup of the area were? Or do you think it was just a general policy?
I think that's a good question. We did look at this issue in our data because there were some Mexicans who did move to the upper Midwest. And when we looked at their outcomes, they generally did just as well as Italian immigrants who moved to those locations. If the Mexican immigrants stayed in Texas, they did much worse. And we even looked within families. So there were some families where we could track and see, oh, so they had older children who grew up and went to school in Texas, but then their younger children went to school in Flint, Michigan, or someplace like that. And their younger children then did much better in school than their older children. And so even within families, we saw dramatic increases in educational attainment if they were able to get out of Texas.
This is so fascinating to me. What about Texas was making this happen? Because initially I thought the through line would be whiteness, but it seems like that was not the only reason.
I think it's a combination of being Mexican in Texas.
Can you elaborate on that?
Because if you look at Italians who moved to Texas, they did really well. And so it was the combination of being Mexican in Texas.
So how were Mexicans perceived in Texas?
Just to speak first to your original question about was the investment because of who the immigrants were? And I think that's an interesting question. I think we didn't really look directly at that question with our data, but I think there are data where one could look at this. And I think that the timing of some of these compulsory schooling laws suggests that some of these education systems were well on their way to being developed before this large wave of industrial era immigration started. So, for example, I believe Massachusetts passed a compulsory schooling law requiring all children to go to school in 1852. And California was relatively early. I think California and Texas are an interesting comparison because California did have a lot of racial animus, but it was directed primarily toward Asians at that time. But they were far more influenced by the progressive movement than the South and Texas at that time. So I think those are some important differences. It seems more complex than, because the immigrants were European, officials decided to invest in those children. I mean, this is in a broader national development context that this is occurring. And I think it's important to remember, and when I teach classes on immigration, my students are always really, I show them a film on Italian immigration, and they're really struck by how unwelcome many of those immigrants from Europe were. They were from a different part of Europe than where the original American settlers were from. They were viewed very differently and viewed really as a racial threat to the country. So that seems to at least complicate the idea.
I would add to that just a little bit, because I know that there's historical stories told about Italian families where they really wanted their children to be working because they needed the money, right? And the truant officer would come and say, no, you have to be sending your kids to school. And there was a lot of resistance in the Italian community, you know, against those truancy laws.
I wonder if that resistance existed within Mexican immigrant families.
Oh, good question. I don't know the answer to that.
One thing that we learned, and Jenny mentioned the wonderful work by David Montejano, the historian, he cites, there was a study done by an economist in the 1930s in Texas, a study of Mexican workers at that time. And he found that, for example, school administrators really found themselves kind of in a difficult position because Texas passed a compulsory schooling law in 1915. But even as late as into the 1930s, this study I'm referring to was finding school superintendents who were saying, I can't force Mexican kids into school because the community will get mad at me. I'll lose my job if I compel Mexican children into school because the institutions in that part of, or in Texas at that time, were more controlled by local elites who had local economic interests. Another thing, I guess just a personal anecdote, one thing I discovered as Jenny and I were kind of researching our own immigration stories, my family comes from German-speaking immigrants who had been living in what is now Ukraine and resettled to the U.S. in the early part of the 20th century, using land granted through the Land Grant Act. So my family were homesteaders in North Dakota, but they were resistant. I discovered a report, kind of a historical report of the ethnic groups of North Dakota, and saw my group there. And it was somewhat stereotypical, it felt, in terms of how the groups were being described, but I learned that it seems my ethnic group was especially averse to sending their kids, off the farm and into the school. So it was, these resistance, I think, happened everywhere. But what developed were institutions, their goal was to provide universal schooling. And what we see in our data is that kids who were in those kinds of school contexts, whether they were poor or not, whatever their racial and ethnic background was, there was less inequality in educational attainment in those places.
We are talking about it in past tense, right? This was happening in the 20s and the 30s. As an immigrant who came in early 2000s, I can tell you that this structural inequality, which is such an abstract idea, exists in many forms, right? Depending on, again, what kind of immigrant you are, where are you coming from, what your ethnicity is, what your religious background is. Do you see echoes of what you saw during your research happening in the 20s and 30s manifest now? And if so, in what ways, especially in Texas?
I can't speak about Texas specifically, actually, because Texas made a lot of improvements over the last 30 years in making education, especially high school and some college, more available to Latinos. And we actually, in the book, we talk a lot about those improvements. But in the last chapter of our book, we really zone in on what we see as the new forms of exclusion today. And there are many. One of the ones that we have really focused on a lot is immigration status.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. We've got a lot of ongoing research right now on how, what does that mean? Not just for the immigrants themselves, but for their children.
So what have you discovered so far?
Well, I mean, it's some of our work, but some of other people's work as well. So I'm trying to give credit where credit's due, right? One of the big things is paying for college. So we have an educational system where you can go to public school and it's paid for by taxpayers up through 12th grade. But then after that, it costs something. And we think that those financial costs are a barrier for a lot of families if they don't have the resources to pay for that. Being an undocumented immigrant, it can severely reduce your ability to raise funds for things like college. These things are coming from families. It's not something that comes from the government.
Yeah, that's so true. But then there are two parallel themes, right? Two parallel storylines that we are dealing with. One, access to education, but then the quality of education, which is pretty much contingent on what neighborhood you're living in, how much taxes you're paying, which again limits a lot of people's ability to go to great colleges because of low quality of education. It's almost impossible for them to compete when it comes to standardized tests and when it comes to writing these long essays and having those credentials. I wonder if this discrimination, again, is very intentional in terms of the amount of funding that goes to low income versus high income neighborhoods.
I think what it is, it's a feature people don't really have a lot of incentive to fix, right? This is a structural issue in the way that we fund schools. You know, a lot of times schools are funded based on local tax base instead of based on state level funding that's distributed evenly. You know, I don't think there's a huge incentive to change that at the moment right now.
The complexity of school funding, it gets a little beyond my expertise. But I think one lesson from the book in terms of institutions is, it seems, is how important they are. And coming back to what Jenny was talking about, kind of this, we're a very individualistic country. And so it's not a surprise that we really emphasize the mobility story, the individual mobility story of our immigrant narrative in this country. The institutions that were created during this time, while imperfect, of course, they also accomplished some really remarkable things in terms of at least the integration of this large and very poor and marginalized group of European immigrants. And we found that when Mexicans were in those same institutional contexts, they did well. So I think speaking specifically about school funding is a little beyond my expertise, but I think a broader lesson is that, you know, these institutions play really important roles. The implications are long lasting. We see that you know, that the inequality that was produced, you know, for Mexicans who were living in Texas, that has continued for generations, because then, you know, these things are passed through family.
I want to circle back to your book. Now, James, you mentioned comparison to California, right? And I'm curious to know what made that comparison so compelling and what did it help reveal in the process?
So in the early 20th century, the grandparents of today's Mexican Americans, when they came to the United States, many of them either settled in Texas or they settled in California and doing very similar work. But the interesting thing is that Texas was settled and its economy organized in a different way than it was in California. So in Texas, it was organized by people who wanted to continue the institution of slavery. And then when that ended, to continue something that looked like slavery, but wasn't. And so that was the Jim Crow system of labor controls that they instituted at that time. And Montejano has all kinds of examples in his book of how that worked. In California, though, probably I'm drawing too stark of a comparison here, so I don't want to make it sound like California was a paradise, because it wasn't. But it was settled by Midwestern progressives, you know, and so there was early indicators of sort of this early progressive movement in California. So like there was, for example, a governor that was elected in the 1910s that are teens that, you know, set up this commission on immigrant settlement and integration, you know, like, and so they were thinking about, instead of keeping kids out of school and separated, they were thinking about developing programs to integrate immigrants into the mainstream society there. And so I think the approach was completely different.
When you say progressives, because progressivism has evolved and there are so many definitions, I just want to lay it out there for listeners. What do you mean by progressives at the time? What was the ideology? What are we referencing here?
That's a great question. You know, so the progressives, if you go back 100 years, there was a group of people, you know, and they often lived in the Midwest, the Northeast, some in California, that identified as progressives. And so they belonged to this progressive movement. It was part of a bigger social work movement that really set out to eradicate poverty. And when it came to thinking about immigrants, they wanted to do something that we might find distasteful today, but they called it Americanize. They wanted to Americanize them. And so, you know, and in that sense, they wanted to turn them into American citizens, for one, but then also get them more integrated. They pushed education. They thought of schools as being sort of the vehicle for the Americanization of the children of immigrants at that time. And so, you know, from a 21st century perspective, this may not be viewed as being, you know, such a great thing to do because, you know, they were ethnocentric. We sort of draw this comparison between the sort of the ethnocentricism of the progressive movement at the time versus the racism of what was going on in Texas. And one was trying to include groups and the other was trying to exclude them. And so...
But both in a patronizing way, though.
Yes, I would say so. Yeah.
I think that at the national level, sometimes when you read the Americanization rhetoric, it sounds as if there is this effort to kind of rid the immigrant communities of their inferior culture and to adopt a more superior American culture. I think what I found interesting, and I think this happens when we use dichotomies, you know, we talk about ethnocentric versus racist context. I think on the ground, things are more complicated and we had to look at a lot of historical data. And so I spent a lot of time reading old 300-page government reports from these fledgling, you know, bureaus and agencies of education in California and in Texas. And as Jenny was talking about, there was this kind of Americanization infrastructure that was created in these governments, in these places. And on the ground, if you were reading, like, for example, reports from the superintendent of education in California would have chapters on, you know, how to teach immigrant children. And those were far more, I think, palatable in that you would read teachers saying, you know, we really have to learn and understand these communities to properly teach them. And how are we going to integrate them into our communities if we treat their culture as somehow inferior? So I think, you know, on the ground in these places, there was a lot more sensitivity to that. And then what was notable at the same time in Texas, in similar reports from the Texas superintendent of education, was really just the absence of any institutional attention to group difference or providing, you know, education to certain groups at all.
It's so fascinating to me because my kids, born and raised here, they went to public schools in a fairly affluent neighborhood. And to me, when I think of Americanization as you're defining it, I feel it's present even to this day, especially in how teachers approach different ethnic groups of students, right? And it may not be as explicit, but it exists. And I wonder if it goes back to those initial years of Americanization and ethnocentric education that may have lingered on even to this day.
Oh, I think it's been present in the country since its beginnings. You've heard of the famous Benjamin Franklin quote, you know, about being overrun by Germans and German-speaking people and needing to eliminate that because we just can't stand to have that difference.
Focus on both of you, like as researchers, what was it like to hold space for stories that can be painful, right? What was your objective through this? Like, did you feel a responsibility beyond just reporting the data and drawing conclusions?
For me, it's really trying to understand what are the roots of inequality today? You know, and I think it goes back. It's not something that we can learn about by just looking at what's happening now, but we need to go back in time to look at the roots and the underlying reasons for that. And it goes way back. You know, I always think there's an historical side of this. And as a person who, you know, my family came from the Netherlands three or four generations ago. And without us also, like from my family's perspective and my community's perspective, without actually taking a very close look at what happened in the past, it's hard for us to understand why we have the privileges that we have today.
Why do you think people are not looking at the past?
It's hard, for one. Feels better, right? To feel like you did it all on your own.
It makes for a good narrative.
As a demographer and an academic, my goal has always been, and I think that was kind of the motivation of this book, was to produce rigorous information first and foremost. There's so much misinformation about immigration today. And I think that as with a lot of issues, especially with our current public discourse, you know, everything gets kind of shoehorned into opposing camps. There's no room for nuance or complexity. And I think I've learned, like, taking a historical focus has really kind of provided a kind of a new view of the present, you know? And I think it's important to kind of compare where we were 100 years ago and where we are today, because I think that, you know, at the time, of the progressive movement, for example, the country was very isolationist. The world was very unstable, very, very similar to what we're experiencing right now. So I think we have always had this through line of celebrating our individual immigration stories, but also being suspicious of newly arriving immigrants like Benjamin Franklin. And at the same time, that has fluctuated. And it's made me look at the present moment more, I don't know if I want to say sympathetically, but just that we're also in a very complex moment. And it's really hard to understand the moment we're living in. And it's much easier to kind of go back because there's not emotion, you know, there. It's kind of a different time.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels between now and 1924. So if you go back 100 years.
Can you share a few with us?
Well, in 1924, Congress passed what's called the Johnson-Reed Act, and that closed the doors to immigration from Central and Eastern Europe and all of Asia. And I feel that the nation right now is in the mood, the same kind of mood. And there are huge efforts to severely restrict the number of immigrants coming. And it comes out of this lack of optimism about what immigrants bring to the country and what their capacities are to be successful and to contribute to American culture and American society and the economy. There is so much concern about it being sort of a zero-sum game. If somebody were to move here from another country and have a job, that means I don't have a job, you know? And there's this sense of it being zero-sum. But we know from looking at history, it's not that way. Immigrants often bring skills and ideas and start businesses and contribute in all kinds of ways to economies and societies that actually expand opportunities for everybody.
I feel as an immigrant, there is lack of connection or connectivity between what immigrants bring and who immigrants are. So people are eager to consume immigrant food, but then they cannot make that connection of, oh, this food comes from that part of the world, which means that an immigrant brought it here. Because immigrant identity itself is so tabooed. It's not normalized in America. We are missing that link, that through line of immigrant identity and how it's shaped America. Your target audience? Do you have an audience in mind who should absolutely read this book?
The way I was thinking about when I was reading this book, and this is sort of a shout out to my mother and her book group, and I think they should read the book.
I'm curious to know, Jennifer, why.
Well, you know, they're interested. I love her book group. And because I end up inheriting a lot of the books that they read, and then I go and read them. And they're always very interested in learning about social issues. And they read fiction and nonfiction and books about different groups of people. And I think they would enjoy reading about this. And it would give them some insight about the world and why it is the way it is today.
What about you, James? Do you have an audience in mind for this book?
Well, we wrote the book in part to appeal to undergraduates at universities, but I think it would really appeal to anyone, like Jenny was saying, who's interested in American history, in our immigration history, and in policy. So I think policymakers would benefit from reading the book as well.
That's the right answer, Jim.
What is the one most inconvenient fact in the book, in your opinion? It may be different for different people. And one most necessary truth that needs to get out.
Inconvenient fact.
Huh. Inconvenient for whom, I think is how I would.
Mm-hmm. Let's just say for America.
I feel like it's inconvenient sometimes to think about the variations that there were in the different ways that immigrants were treated, right? So America has always had what I thought of as being a labor problem. There's always been an insatiable demand for inexpensive labor. But different parts of the country have approached this problem and solved it in different ways. And some have been more exploitative than others. And we're doing it now through the form of undocumented immigration. So it is continuing today.
You're absolutely right about undocumented immigrants. But do you think documented immigrants are also exploited, whether they come here for education, whether they have these, you know, great professional opportunities and jobs? They are still exploited relative to the local population.
I'd have to think about that a little bit, because when I think about people without papers, they're in a much more precarious situation. Now, maybe that's changing, but in terms of being able to pick a different job, ask for more wages, say something that's not quite right about what's going on at work, I think that people without those legal protections are in a much more precarious situation than others. And I agree with you that maybe immigrants with a green card who are not citizens might fall in between in terms of being exploitable.
Or immigrants on H-1B.
Exactly. That would be another in-between status.
It's like you can't switch jobs. You have to stick with one employer if you want the green card, if you want them to sponsor your green card. That's something that was a constant struggle until we were able to get our green card and citizenship. It doesn't get talked about as much, but it's an actual real struggle that people face and they go through.
Yeah, I can appreciate what you're saying.
James, what about you?
In response to?
The inconvenient truth.
I mean, I don't know that these are inconvenient truths, but perhaps maybe might problematize narratives. One is, at least, you know, on more kind of left-leaning observers, there tends to be, I think, or maybe among teachers, I don't know. I just remember when No Child Left Behind was passed, there was a lot of controversy about it. And we didn't find this, we reported on other findings that showed that the children of immigrant groups, or I mean, they weren't measured that way in the data, but for example, Hispanic Latino children, they really benefited in terms of higher test scores. And you know, we could have another debate about test scores, not really my area, but there was almost kind of, there were really large effects of that law on the measurable kind of testing outcomes of the country's most disadvantaged students. And
we're seeing the positive benefits of that now in terms of finishing high school and going on beyond it. I'm sorry to jump in, but...
Well, Jenny and I have talked about that. And I think that, you know, it speaks not just to the importance of money as investments, but also just attention to a problem and having powerful people and policymakers train their focus on that problem and try to address it. So that requires a lot of people coming together and agreeing there is a problem.
Well, and with the dismantlement of the Department of Education is not going to help with this. Yeah.
Yeah. How sad is that?
I'm sorry, Jim.
I think in this historical exercise, I've just noted some ways that we talk about things today that seem kind of fixed. But when we look historically, it might complicate the way we look at things. And one thing is race, for example. You know, there's a debate about, well, what lessons can we learn from this European industrial era immigration? That they were included in all of these mobility, you know, important institutions for mobility because they were white. And that is one, I think, interpretation, but race meant something very different. At that time, and it wasn't clear what race the Italians were. You know, for example, who, as I understand it, the initial Italian immigrants didn't even identify as Italians, right? They were Sicilian. It was in America where they became Italians, whatever that meant at that time. So I think it means that this, the process of developing a racial identity is very context specific or potentially, you know, for example, in our data, it seems that Mexicans in Texas were treated in some other way based on their schooling outcomes. But in Chicago and Detroit, their schooling outcomes characterize them as just like another European ethnic group in those places. So I think that it speaks to, you know, the danger of kind of speaking in absolutes, because when we go back historically, things are always more complicated than they are when we project our current kind of situation backwards.
I mean, when we look at historical documents of what happened, like in the turn of the 20th century, I mean, there was this giant report called the Dillingham Report. And I don't know if you've heard of that, but there's whole chapters on it about race and the race of the new immigrants. And the interesting thing is they talk about race in terms of, it's very different than the way we think about race now. And, you know, so like every single European origin group had a different race and a different label. I don't even know. Teutonics was one group.
Hmm.
The Dalmatians, that sounds like the dogs, right? There were all these different, the Hebrews, they called them Hebrews, even though they were Jewish from Eastern Europe. There was dozens of different racial groups that were identified in that report, and they were racialized. So like there was attributes attached to those groups. This group is especially lazy. This group is especially miserly. This group isn't fit for citizenship. And this was in a government report. I feel like the kind of groups that we talk about today are what we call pan-ethnic groups. And there's efforts to kind of ignore the national differences that we see in cultural groups that are coming.
Where those groups originate from. There are socioeconomic differences, there are ethnic differences, and those differences and those biases are brought into the U.S. as well. So they add another layer of discrimination within certain groups and across. This is going to be fun. So in the end, if you were to define the United States of America, and this is a question I ask all my guests, in a word or a sentence, in the context of, and I'm tweaking it a bit, the research that you've done, how would you define it?
In the context of the research we've done, one word you said?
Or a sentence.
I feel like there's patterns that we continue to see over and over again. So it's repetitive.
I've interviewed 300 people. Never has anyone defined it the way you did, and I love it. It's so true. James, what about you?
Well, if I can limit it to the America of the 20th century, I think that it is a country that accomplished remarkable things institutionally, and I think the America as an integration context is underappreciated. And yet at the same time, those institutions were flawed. And I think now we're kind of trying to figure out how to come to terms with those flaws.
Where can people find this book?
It is available on the Russell Sage Foundation website. And you can also order it on Amazon.
Thank you, James and Jennifer. This was wonderful. I got to learn a lot and I'll be following your work. Thank you for doing this incredible work for all of us to learn from. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Remember what I mentioned in the intro? Some inconvenient truths, some facts, some history that is so important to know about, to understand, to make sense of, contextualize. I would really, really recommend buying this book, getting it, reading it, sharing it with folks who are skeptical or who think they did everything on their own and who are actually the entitled ones. Anyways, this episode was produced and written by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our editor and sound designer is Lou Raskin. Our theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another guest for all of you. And please don't forget to share, like, maybe write a nice review. It's always good to see a good review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us grow. Thank you.